Chapter 8. Fare thee well, and if forever, still forever, fare thee well. Byron. In days when I still bloomed serenely inside our Lycée garden wall, and read my Apuleius keenly, but read no Cicero at all, those springtime days in secret valleys, where swans call out and beauty dallies near waters sparkling in the still, the muse first came to make me thrill. My student cell turned incandescent, and there the muse spread out for me a feast of youthful fancies free, and sang of childhood effervescent the glory of our days of old, the trembling dreams the heart can hold. And with a smile the world caressed us. What wings our first successes gave! The old De Javin saw and blessed us as he descended to the grave. And I, who saw my single duty as heeding passion's siren song, to share with all the world her beauty, would take my merry muse along to rowdy feasts and altercations, the bane of midnight sentry stations, and to each mad and fevered rout she brought her gifts and danced about, Bacchante-like, at all our revels. And over wine she sang for guests. And in those days, when I was blessed, the young pursued my muse like devils, while I, mid friends, was drunk with pride, my flighty mistress at my side. But from that band I soon departed, and fled afar, and she as well. How often on the course I charted, my gentle muse's magic spell would light the way with secret stories. How oft, mid far Caucasia's glories, like fair Lenore on moonlit nights, she rode with me those craggy heights. How often on the shores of Tauris, on misty eaves, she led me down to hear the sea's incessant sound, the Nereid's eternal chorus, that endless chant the waves unfurled in praise of him who made the world. Forgetting then the city's splendour, its noisy feasts and grand events, in sad Moldavia she turned tender and visited the humble tents of wandering tribes, and like a child she learned their ways and soon grew wild. The language of the gods she shed for strange and simple tongues instead, to sing the savage steppe elated. But then her course abruptly veered, and in my garden she appeared, a country miss, infatuated with mournful air and brooding glance, and in her hands a French romance. And now I seize the first occasion to show my muse a grand soirée. I watch with jealous trepidation her rustic charms on full display, and lo, my beauty calmly passes through ranks of men from high-born classes, past diplomats and soldier fops and haughty dames, then calmly stops to sit and watch the grand procession, the gowns, the talk, the milling mass, the slow parade of guests who pass before the hostess in succession, the sombre men who form a frame around each painted bell and dame. She likes the stately disposition of oligarchic colloquies, their chilly pride in high position, the mix of years and ranks she sees. But who is that among the chosen? That figure, standing mute and frozen, that stranger no one seems to know. Before him faces come and go like spectres in a bleak procession. What is it, martyred pride or spleen that marks his face? Is that Eugene, that figure with the strange expression? Can that be he? It is, I say. But when did fate cast him our way? Is he the same, or is he learning, or does he play the outcast still? In what new guise is he returning? What role does he intend to fill? Child Harold? Melmoth for a while? Cosmopolite, a Slavophile, a Quaker, bigot, might one ask? Or will he sport some other mask? Or maybe he's just dedicated, like you and me, to being nice. In any case, here's my advice. Give up a role when it's outdated. He's gulled the world. Now let it go. You know him then? Well, yes and no. But why on earth does he inspire so harsh and negative a view? Is it because we never tire of censuring what others do? Because an ardent spirit's daring appears absurd or overbearing from where the smug and worthless sit? Because the dull are cramped by wit? Because we take mere talk for action and malice rules a petty mind? Because in tripe the solemn find a cause for solemn satisfaction, and mediocrity alone is what we like and call our own? Oh, blessed who in his youth was tender, and blessed who ripened in his prime, who learned to bear without surrender the chill of life with passing time, who never knew exotic visions, nor scorned the social mob's decisions, who was at 20 fop or swell, and then at 30 married well, at 50 shed all obligation for private and for other debts, who gained in turn without regrets great wealth and rank and reputation, of whom lifelong the verdict ran, old X is quite a splendid man. How sad that youth, with all its power, was given us in vain to burn, that we betrayed it every hour, and were deceived by it in turn, that all our finest aspirations, our brightest dreams and inspirations, have withered with each passing day like leaves dank autumn rots away. It's hard to face a long succession of dinners stretching out of sight, to look at life as at a rite, and trail the seemly crowd's procession, indifferent to the views they hold, and to their passions ever cold. When one becomes the butt of rumour, it's hard to bear, as you well know. When men of reason and good humour perceive you as a freak on show, or as a sad and raving creature, a monster of satanic feature, or even demon of my pen, Eugene, to speak of him again, who'd killed his friend for satisfaction, who in an aimless, idle fix had reached the age of 26, annoyed with leisure and inaction, without position, work or wife, could find no purpose for his life. He felt a restless, vague ambition, a craving for a change of air, a most unfortunate condition, a cross not many choose to bear. He left his home in disillusion, and fled the woods and fields' seclusion, where every day before his eyes a bloody spectre seemed to rise. He took up travel for distraction, a single feeling in his breast. But journeys, too, like all the rest, soon proved a wearisome attraction. So he returned one day to fall, like Chatsky, straight from boat to ball. But look! The crowds are stir and humming. A murmur through the ballroom steals. The hostess sees a lady coming, a stately general at her heels. She isn't hurried or obtrusive, is neither cold nor too effusive. She casts no brazen glance around, and makes no effort to astound or use those sorts of affectation and artifice that ladies share, but shows a simple, quiet air. She seems the very illustration du comme il faut. Shishkov, be kind. I can't translate this phrase, I find. The ladies flocked to stand beside her. Old women beamed as she went by. The men bowed lower when they spied her and sought in vain to catch her eye. Young maidens hushed in passing by her, while none held head and shoulders higher than he who brought the lady there, the general with the prideful air. One couldn't label her a beauty, but neither did her form contain from head to toe the slightest strain of what, with fashion's sense of duty, the London social sets decry as vulgar. I won't even try to find an adequate translation for this delicious epithet. With us the word's an innovation, but though it's won no favour yet, 'twould make an epigram of style. But where's our lady all this while? With carefree charm and winsome air, she took a seat beside the chair of brilliant Nina Voronskaya, that Cleopatra of the North. But even Nina, shining forth with all her marble beauty's fire, however dazzling to the sight, could not eclipse her neighbour's light. "Can it be true?" Eugene reflected. "Can that be she? It seems, and yet, from those backwoods." And he directed a curious and keen lorgnette for several minutes in succession upon the lady whose expression called up a face from long ago. "But tell me, Prince, you wouldn't know who's standing there in conversation beside the Spanish envoy, pray? That lady in the red beret?" "You have been out of circulation, but I'll present you now with joy. Who is she, though?" "My wife, old boy."
"You're married? Really?"
"On my honour."
"To whom? How long?"
"Some 2 years since. The Larin girl."
"You mean Tatiana?"
"She knows you?"
"We were neighbours, Prince."
"Well then, come on, we'll go and meet her."
And so the prince led up to greet her his kinsman and his friend Eugene. The princess looked at him, serene. However much the situation disturbed her soul and caused her pain, however great her shock or strain, she gave no hint of agitation. Her manner stayed the same outside. Her bow was calm and dignified. It's true. The lady didn't shiver, or blush, or suddenly turn white, or even let an eyebrow quiver, or press her lips together tight. Although Eugene with care inspected this placid lady, he detected no trace of Tanya from the past. And when he tried to speak at last, he found he couldn't. She inquired when he'd arrived, and if of late he'd been back home at his estate, then gave her spouse a look so tired he took her arm. She moved away and left Eugene in mute dismay. Was this the Tanya he once scolded in that forsaken distant place where first our novel's plot unfolded? The one to whom, when face to face, in such a burst of moral fire, he'd lectured gravely on desire? The girl whose letter he still kept, in which a maiden heart had wept? Where all was shown, all unprotected, was this that girl, or did he dream? That little girl whose warm esteem and humble lot he'd once rejected? And could she now have been so bold, so unconcerned with him, so cold? He left the rout in all its splendour and drove back home immersed in thought. A swarm of dreams, both sad and tender, disturbed the slumber that he sought. He woke to find, with some elation, Prince N. had sent an invitation. Oh, God, I'll see her, and today. Oh, yes, I'll go. And straight away he scrawled a note, he'd be delighted. What's wrong with him? He's in a daze. What's stirring in that idle gaze? What's made that frigid soul excited? Vexation? Pride? Or youth's old yen for all the cares of love again? Once more he counts the hours, pacing. Once more can't wait till day is past. The clock strikes 10 and off he's racing. And now he's at the porch at last. He enters in some apprehension. The princess, to his added tension, is quite alone. Some minutes there they sit. Eugene can only stare. He has no voice. Without a smile, and ill at ease, he scarcely tries to answer her. His mind supplies but one persistent thought the while. His eyes retain their stare, but she sits unconstrained, quite calm and free. Her husband enters, thus arresting this most unpleasant tête-à-tête. Eugene and he recalled the jesting, the pranks and fun when first they'd met. They laughed. Then guests began arriving, and on the spice of malice thriving, the conversation sparkled bright. The hostess kept the banter light and quite devoid of affectations. Good, reasoned talk was also heard, but not a trite or vulgar word. No lasting truths or dissertations, and no one's ears were shocked a bit by all the flow of lively wit. The social cream had gathered gaily, the nobly born and fashion's pets, the faces one encounters daily, the fools one never once forgets, the aged ladies decked in roses, in bonnets and malignant poses, and several maidens far from gay, unsmiling faces on display. And here's an envoy speaking slyly of some most solemn state affair. A greybeard, too, with scented hair, who joked both cleverly and wryly in quite a keen, old-fashioned way, which seems a touch absurd today. And here's a chap whose words are biting, who's cross with everything about, with tea too sweet to be inviting, with banal ladies, men who shout, that foggy book they're all debating, the badge on those two maids-in-waiting, the falsehood in reviews, the war, the snow, his wife, and much, much more. And here's Prolazov, celebrated for loathsomeness of soul, a clown, as you, Saint Priest, have demonstrated in album drawings all through town. Another ballroom king on station, like fashion's very illustration, beside the door stood tightly laced, immobile, mute, and cherub-faced. A traveller, home from distant faring, a brazen chap, all starched and proud, provoked amusement in the crowd by his pretentious, studied bearing. A mere exchange of looks conveyed the sorry sight the fellow made. But my Eugene, all evening heeded Tatiana, only her alone. But not the timid maid who'd pleaded, that poor enamoured girl he'd known, but this cool princess so resplendent, this distant goddess so transcendent, who ruled the queenly Neva's shore. Alas, we humans all ignore our Mother Eve's disastrous history. What's given to us ever palls. Incessantly the serpent calls and lures us to the tree of mystery. We've got to have forbidden fruit, or Eden's joys for us are moot. How changed Tatiana is! How surely she's taken up the role she plays! How quick she's mastered, how securely, her lordly rank's commanding ways! Who'd dare to seek the tender maiden in this serene and glory-laden grande dame of lofty social spheres? Yet once he'd moved her heart to tears. Her virgin brooding once had cherished sweet thoughts of him in darkest night, while Morpheus still roamed in flight, and gazing at the moon, she'd nourished a tender dream that she some day might walk with him life's humble way. To love, all ages yield surrender, but to the young its raptures bring a blessing bountiful and tender, as storms refresh the fields of spring. Neath passion's reins they green and thicken, renew themselves with joy and quicken, and vibrant life in taking root sends forth rich blooms and gives sweet fruit. But when the years have made us older, and barren age has shown its face, how sad is faded passion's trace! Thus storms in autumn, blowing colder, turn meadows into marshy ground and strip the forest bare all round. Alas, it's true. Eugene's demented, in love with Tanya like a boy. He spends each day and night tormented by thoughts of love, by dreams of joy. Ignoring reason's condemnation, each day he rides to take his station outside her glassed-in entryway, then follows her about all day. He's happy just to be around her, to help her with her shawl or furs, to touch a torrid hand to hers, to part the footmen who surround her in liveried ranks where'er she calls, or fetch the kerchief when it falls. She pays him not the least attention, no matter what he tries to do. At home, receives him without tension, in public, speaks a word or two, or sometimes merely bows on meeting, or passes by without a greeting. She's no coquette in any part. The monde abhors a fickle heart. Onegin, though, is fading quickly. She doesn't see or doesn't care. Onegin, wasting, has the air of one consumptive, wan and sickly. He's urged to seek his doctor's view, and these suggest a spa or two. But he refused to go. He's ready to join his forebears any day. Tatiana, though, stayed calm and steady. Their sex, alas, is hard to sway. And yet he's stubborn, still resistant, still hopeful, and indeed persistent. Much bolder than most healthy men, he chose, with trembling hand, to pen the princess an impassioned letter. Though on the whole he saw no sense in missives writ in love's defence, and with good cause, he found it better than bearing all his pain unheard. So here's his letter, word for word. Onegin's letter to Tatiana. I know you'll feel a deep distress at this unwanted revelation. What bitter scorn and condemnation your haughty glance may well express. What aims, what hopes do I envision in opening my soul to you? What wicked and deserved derision perhaps I give occasion to. When first I met you and detected a warmth in you quite unexpected, I dared not trust in love again. I didn't yield to sweet temptation, and had, it's true, no inclination to lose my hateful freedom then. What's more, poor, guiltless Lenski perished, and his sad fate drew us apart. From all that I had ever cherished, I tore away my grieving heart. Estranged from men and discontented, I thought in freedom, peace of mind, a substitute for joy I'd find. How wrong I've been, and how tormented. But no, each moment of my days to see you and pursue you madly, to catch your smile and search your gaze with loving eyes that seek you gladly, to melt with pain before your face, to hear your voice, to try to capture with all my soul your perfect grace, to swoon and pass away, what rapture! And I'm deprived of this. For you I search on all the paths I wander. Each day is dear, each moment too. Yet I in futile dullness squander these days allotted me by fate. Oppressive days, indeed, of late. My span on earth is all but taken, but lest too soon I join the dead, I need to know, when I awaken, I'll see you in the day ahead. I fear that in this meek petition your solemn gaze may only spy the cunning of a base ambition, and I can hear your stern reply. But if you knew the anguish in it, to thirst with love in every part, to burn, and with the mind each minute to calm the tumult in one's heart, to long to clasp in adoration your knees, and sobbing at your feet, pour out confessions, lamentation, oh, all that I might then entreat, and meantime, feigning resignation, to arm my gaze and speech with lies, to look at you with cheerful eyes and hold a placid conversation. But let it be. It's now too late for me to struggle at this hour. The die is cast. I'm in your power, and I surrender to my fate. No answer came. Eugene elected to write again, and then once more, with no reply. He drives, dejected, to some soiree, and by the door sees her at once. Her harshness stuns him. Without a word, the lady shuns him. My God, how stern that haughty brow! What wintry frost surrounds her now! Her lips express determination to keep her fury in control. Onegin stares with all his soul. But where's distress, commiseration, and where the tear stains? Not a trace. There's wrath alone upon that face. And, maybe, secret apprehension lest monde or husband misconstrue an episode too slight to mention, the tale that my Onegin knew. But he departs, his hopes in tatters, and damns his folly in these matters, and plunging into deep despond, he once again rejects the monde. And he recalled with grim emotion, behind his silent study door, how wicked spleen had once before pursued him through the world's commotion, had seized him by the collar then, and locked him in a darkened den. Once more he turned to books and sages. He read his Gibbon and Rousseau, Chamfort, Manzoni, Herder's pages, Madame de Stael, Bichat, Tissot, the sceptic Bayle he quite devoured, the works of Fontenelle he scoured. He even read some Russians, too. Nor did he scorn the odd review, those journals where each modern Moses instructs us in a moral way, where I'm so much abused today, but where such madrigals and roses I used to meet with now and then. E sempre bene, gentlemen. And yet, although his eyes were reading, his thoughts had wandered far apart. Desires, dreams, and sorrows pleading had crowded deep within his heart. Between the printed lines lay hidden quite other lines that rose unbidden before his gaze, and these alone absorbed his soul. As he was shown, the heart's dark secrets and traditions, the mysteries of its ancient past, disjointed dreams, obscure and vast, vague threats and rumours, premonitions, a drawn-out tale of fancies grand, and letters in a maiden's hand. But then, as torpor dulled sensation, his feelings and his thoughts went slack, while in his mind imagination dealt out her motley pharaoh pack. He sees a youth, quite still, reposing on melting snow, as if he's dozing on bivouac, then hears with dread a voice proclaim, "Well then, he's dead!" He sees forgotten foes he'd bested, base cowards, slanderers full-blown, unfaithful women he had known, companions whom he now detested, a country house, a window-sill, where she sits waiting, waiting still. He got so lost in his depression, he just about went mad, I fear, or else turned poet, an obsession that I'd have been the first to cheer. It's true, by self-hypnotic action, my muddled pupil in distraction came close to grasping at that time the principles of Russian rhyme. He looked the poet so completely, when by the hearth he'd sit alone, and Benedetto he'd intone, or sometimes Idol Mio sweetly, while on the flames he'd drop unseen his slipper or his magazine. The days flew by. The winter season dissolved amid the balmy air. He didn't die, or lose his reason, or turn a poet in despair. With spring he felt rejuvenated. The cell in which he'd hibernated so marmot-like through winter's night, the hearth, the double panes shut tight, he quit one sparkling morn and sprinted along the Neva's bank by sleigh. On hacked-out bluish ice that lay beside the road the sunlight glinted. The rutted snow had turned to slush. But where, in such a headlong rush, has my Eugene directly hastened? You've guessed already. Yes, indeed, the moody fellow, still unchastened, has flown to Tanya's in his need. He enters like a dead man, striding through empty hall, then passes, gliding through grand salon, and on, all bare, he opens up a door. What's there that strikes him with such awful pleading? The princess sits alone in sight, quite unadorned, her face gone white above some letter that she's reading, and cheek in hand as down she peers, she softly sheds a flood of tears. In that brief instant, then, who couldn't have read her tortured heart at last? And in the princess, then, who wouldn't have known poor Tanya from the past? Mad with regret and anguished feeling, Eugene fell down before her, kneeling. She shuddered, but she didn't speak, just looked at him, her visage bleak, without surprise or indignation. His stricken, sick, extinguished eyes, imploring aspect, mute replies, she saw it all. In desolation, the simple girl he'd known before, who'd dreamt and loved, was born once more. Her gaze upon his face still lingers. She does not bid him rise or go, does not withdraw impassive fingers from avid lips that press them so. What dreams of hers were reenacted? The heavy silence grew protracted until at last she whispered low, "Enough. Get up. To you I owe a word of candid explanation. Onegin, do you still retain some memory of that park and lane where fate once willed our confrontation, and I so meekly heard you preach? It's my turn now to make a speech. Onegin, I was then much younger, I dare say better looking too, and loved you with a girlish hunger. But what did I then find in you? What answer came? Just stern rejection. A little maiden's meek affection to you, I'm sure, was trite and old. Oh, God, my blood can still turn cold when I recall how you reacted. Your frigid glance, that sermonette. But I can't blame you, or forget how nobly, in a sense, you acted, how right toward me that awful day. I'm grateful now, in every way. Back then, far off from vain commotion in our backwoods, as you'll allow, you had no use for my devotion. So why do you pursue me now? Why mark me out for your attention? Is it perhaps my new ascension to circles that you find more swank, or that I now have wealth and rank, or that my husband, maimed in battle, is held in high esteem at court? Or would my fall perhaps be sport, a cause for all the monde to tattle, which might in turn bring you some claim to social scandal's kind of fame? I'm weeping. Oh, at this late hour, if you recall your Tanya still, then know that were it in my power, I'd much prefer words harsh and chill, stern censure in your former fashion, to this offensive show of passion, to all these letters and these tears. Oh, then at least my tender years aroused in you some hint of kindness. You pitied then my girlish dreams, but now, what unbecoming schemes have brought you to my feet? What blindness! Can you, so strong of mind and heart, now stoop to play so base a part? To me, Onegin, all these splendours, this weary, tinselled life of mine, this homage that the great world tenders, my stylish house where princes dine, are empty. I'd as soon be trading this tattered life of masquerading, this world of glitter, fumes and noise, for just my books, the simple joys of our old home, its walks and flowers, for all those haunts that I once knew, where first, Onegin, I saw you, for that small churchyard's shaded bowers, where over my poor nanny now there stands a cross beneath a bough. And happiness was ours, so nearly, it came so close. But now my fate has been decreed. I may have merely been foolish when I failed to wait. But mother, with her lamentation, implored me, and in resignation, all futures seemed alike in woe, I married. Now, I beg you, go! I faith in you and do not tremble. I know that in your heart reside both honour and a manly pride. I love you. Why should I dissemble? But I am now another's wife, and I'll be faithful all my life. She left him then. Eugene, forsaken, stood seared, as if by heaven's fire. How deep his stricken heart is shaken, with what a tempest of desire! A sudden clink of spurs rings loudly as Tanya's husband enters proudly, and here, at this unhappy turn for my poor hero, we'll adjourn and leave him, reader, at his station for long, forever. In his train, we've roamed the world down one slim lane for long enough. Congratulation on reaching land at last. Hooray! And long since time, I'm sure you'd say. Whatever, reader, your reaction, and whether you be foe or friend, I hope we part in satisfaction as comrades now. Whatever end you may have sought in these reflections, tumultuous, fond recollections, relief from labours for a time, live images or wit in rhyme, or maybe merely faulty grammar, God grant that in my careless art, for fun, for dreaming, for the heart, for raising journalistic clamour, you found at least a crumb or two. And so let's part. Farewell. Adieu. Farewell you too, my moody neighbour, and you, my true ideal, my own, and you, small book, my constant labour, in whose bright company I've known all that a poet's soul might cherish. Oblivion, when tempests flourish, sweet talk with friends on which I've fed. Oh, many, many days have fled since young Tatiana, with her lover, as in a misty dream at night, first floated dimly into sight. And I as yet could not uncover, or through the magic crystal see, my novel's shape, or what would be. But those to whom, as friends and brothers, my first few stanzas I once read, some are no more, and distant others, as Sa'di long before us said. Without them, my Onegin's fashioned, and she from whom I drew impassioned my fair Tatiana's noblest trait. Oh, much, too much you've stolen, fate. But blessed is he who rightly gauges the time to quit the feast and fly, who never drained life's chalice dry, nor read its novel's final pages, but all at once, for good, withdrew, as I from my Onegin do.